This is exactly right.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hi, I'm Erin Welsh.
And I'm Erin Alman Updike, and we're the hosts of This Podcast Will Kill You on Exactly Right.
We're back with our seventh season, which is bigger and better than ever.
Because guess what? We're now a weekly show.
This season, we're tackling everything from long COVID to norovirus, from the supplement industry to IVF, and so, so much more.
New episodes drop every single Tuesday.
Follow This Podcast Will Kill You wherever you get your podcasts.
This view is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, you see this, and this is very, all this property that we've looked at, it's so, like, you could see that it's really something that's worthwhile, and mm-hmm. this is what his legacy would be built on. If this had stayed in the Cornell hands, it would have been a pretty remarkable, I'm assuming.
So they were able to recoup a good portion of the property because it went to his sons. They did take their tithe, I suppose you would say, but he was able to stay here, and the Cornells did stay on for a while, but, you know, in terms of the status was so much.
We're back in 1673 in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, learning the tragic story of Rebecca Briggs Cornell. Her relative, Carrie Nolte, and I are on her land 350 years later. And Carrie is right. Status was really important to Rebecca and to her son, Thomas Cornell Jr., and his wife, Sarah.
He had had several positions, like his father before him, in the town of some import that showed that he was a person of standing. He wasn't, you know, the highest. He wasn't the richest, but he was a somebody. And Sarah might have been someone who also felt that just by virtue of her standing followed her husband's.
Yeah.
And to constantly, when he sees other men being the heads of their household, to constantly be seen, you know, to feel as though he was still under his mother's thumb.
It had been a difficult winter with Thomas and Sarah and their four children all packed into the cramped upper floor of Rebecca's home, biding their time until they could inherit the entire thing.
So you don't get the sense that the land and whatever bad deal his mother would have given him was still worth killing her?
I think it would have been. I think it was resentment over years. I mean, it's never just the money. But she did have enough to loan him the equivalent of $26,000 that he was not willing to pay back. So maybe it was that his crops were failing, that his business wasn't doing well, that, you know, and he felt this was his birthright, and he had been waiting and waiting and waiting for this, forgive the language, stupid old bitch to die.
Yeah.
And she just wouldn't do it.
On the cold winter evening of December 8th, 1673, Rebecca's son, Thomas Jr., left his mother alone in her room after chatting with her for more than an hour. Local historian Gloria Schmidt says that there didn't seem to be anything unusual about that night.
You know, I don't know what time they would have had supper, but in February, the light goes very quickly. So I would assume that, you know, dinner would have been about 5 or so. So if this was after dinner, it would be after dark. Thomas was with his mother alone before supper. And he said that he was helping her with spinning, and he had this spindle.
Later, Thomas would have no more details to offer. But most people knew that there had been acrimony between mother and son for some time, mostly over money. And there had also been troubles between Thomas's wife, Sarah Earle, and her mother-in-law. Rebecca had been depressed. In fact, she was so unhappy that she was secretly planning to move in with a different son. And Thomas was miserable too. He was in constant debt to his mother, who controlled the land and the money. That night, Thomas left his mother as he often did, sitting by the fire, knitting and puffing on a pipe. That had been Rebecca's habit, especially during the long winter months when she spent so much more time inside. The 73-year-old spent much of her time with the family, taking care of her young grandchildren. Her daughter-in-law was pregnant and ill-tempered, at least according to her. Rebecca had greatly preferred Thomas's first wife. She craved peace and quiet. Rebecca complained to neighbors and friends that her son and Sarah forced her to take care of the animals, even when it was frigid outside. The acrimony between the two was deep. Something was bound to happen. That night, Rebecca had rejected Thomas's offer of dinner, which had featured salted mackerel, one of her favorites. But Rebecca hadn't been feeling very well. After Thomas left, the family ate supper. Soon, Sarah sent her stepson Edward down to Rebecca's room to bring her a glass of milk to settle her stomach.
And so after dinner, he went in, the son, Edward, I think, was going to go in and ask her, do you want some milk? And when he went in, he saw the fire.
Edward screamed for his family to come as he stood over a body. Thomas Cornell and his wife Sarah rushed inside and stared at the figure on the floor, smoldering and partially on fire. It didn't move.
He came out and asked, if my memory's correct, he asked for something to light the way so that they could see, because everything was dark in the room.
One of the hired men, Harry Strait, reached down and shook the person, speaking to them in a Native American language.
Henry thought that she was burned enough that he didn't recognize who she was. Her head was facing the fireplace. Some of the curtains on the bedding had been burned. There was ashes on the floor. And Henry Strait talked to this individual on the floor and spoke in a native tongue. And Thomas said, oh Lord, it is my mother.
It didn't make sense, and Sarah and Thomas seemed confused at first. How could something like this have happened?
It's implied in the record that the way that Thomas recognized her was from her shoes.
Oh, wow.
But it's also dark. There's no lights, there's candlelight, and there's firelight. And at this point, it's not a roaring fire.
Okay.
It's kind of a smoldering fire in the hearth and on Rebecca.
Thomas and his wife seemed shocked and panicked. It was clear there was no use trying to save her at this point. Even though Rebecca Cornell had been miserable in her later years, she had found peace knowing that she had done all she could for her friends and family. She had had an eventful life. Rebecca had endured religious persecution prior to adopting the Quaker faith. She had survived a massacre, experiencing the brutal murder of her closest friend and that woman's family, and she had suffered the death of her beloved husband. But now, her life had been reduced to this, a charred body, still smoldering on the floor, as her son stood over her. Rebecca Cornell's legacy should be more than just her death. But regardless, that's why so many New Englanders know about her today. Thomas covered his mother with a sheet and shut the door behind him, still seemingly working to process what happened to her. Rebecca's relative, Carrie Nolte, says that her body was in terrible condition, and it was all a little confusing forensically. But let's talk about that later.
They had found Rebecca Briggs Cornell laid on her left side, burned from her torso to the tops of her legs, and dead. They had an inquest the next day to try and see what might have caused this, you know, what are the circumstances.
The next morning, Thomas called on the area's coroner to tell him that his mother had died in a fire in her bedroom. The coroner shook his head, offered his condolences, and recruited two Portsmouth residents to serve as the jury for an inquest.
So the coroner would come, and the coroner would have a coroner's jury. So there would be, you know, people that would come in and they would, you know, look at the body and determine whether or not it was an accident or not.
Frankly, this does sound like an accident. And as we said before, with fire being the primary heat source at this time in history, it wasn't unheard of for women or men to catch themselves on fire. Clothing was more flammable than it is today. Most people smoked pipes. They often used coal or oil as fuel. It was just a significantly more dangerous situation. So very quickly, the coroner's jury seemed to be leaning toward it being an accident, say historians Gloria Schmidt and Ann Burns.
So part of the idea that some have, if they're looking at it being an accident, is that this happened a lot. Women had if they were by the fire, their clothes might catch on fire. If they were smoking and she was known to smoke, ashes might fall on the clothes and start a fire.
And she was known to smoke a pipe. It kind of sounds like maybe she was sitting in a chair, smoking a pipe, the curtains caught on fire.
Historian Nell Darby agrees. It did happen often between the prevalence of fire in homes and the sheer amount of fabric in colonial clothing, especially during a New England winter.
Even the 19th century, in case I've looked at, there have been so many cases of individuals dying by being set on fire. And, it's always accidental. You know, they've got too close to a candle. They've got too close to the fire. They've been cooking and a spark has kind of set fire to their clothing.
But soon there were questions because Rebecca wasn't the only thing that was smoldering. There was also fire damage to her bedding and the bed.
It was strange because her head is facing the fireplace, but the curtains on the bed and the bedding was behind her. So it's whether or not she started in the bed and caught fire in the bed, and then she tried to get up and get out. But it was a very common thing for women's clothes to catch on fire.
So rather than just sitting in the chair when it happened, Rebecca might have been smoking her pipe in bed and accidentally caught herself on fire, then stumbled out of bed and fallen to the floor. And there were other theories. Joe Ochi, the owner of the Valley Inn, heard a different story about what might have happened that night.
You know, an hour or two later, when someone wanted to check on her, she's dead. And tripped and fell in front of the fireplace in her room, which I have since found out was apparently a fairly common way to die back then. Mm-hmm. If you look at it that way, in terms of things that are common.
The bottom of the bed caught on fire. She went to put it out. She may have fallen, you know.
So in this version, she tripped near the fireplace and then the fire jumped from there to her clothes and to the bed. Joe reminds us that the colonists dealt with fire more often than we do.
We wouldn't think of it that way, but when you really do think about it, there's no alternate form of heat. So you're getting up every hour or two and feeding the fire. And because the fireplaces were pretty inefficient and it's in the middle of winter, people were wearing to bed things that we wear outside. So, you know, clothing down to your ankles. And so a frail older woman without benefit of a light switch to turn on is, you know, trips, falls, dies. Probably should have been the end of the story.
We'll get more into that soon. But first, let's go back to the theory that Rebecca accidentally set herself on fire.
You know, like when we think about a canopy bed, there were curtains around the bed, and then the bed clothes themselves, and those were partially burnt. But what quenched the fire? Because you would have thought that the fire would have gone on. But when Edward came into the room, he saw some fire, but there really wasn't, you know, a big conflagration. It was some fire. He couldn't see. He had to ask someone to you know, bring in candles or whatever so that they could see what it was. So it was a very dark room. So it wasn't an enormous fire.
Gloria's point is, what actually stopped the fire from burning more? Did someone else put it out, or did Rebecca roll? And something else bothers Gloria, the types of fabrics that Rebecca wore. The specific pieces that burned and those that didn't seem a little odd.
The only strange thing was that she had on wool and cotton, and usually the wool will not burn, but the cotton will. And in this case, it was the opposite. The wool burned, but the cotton did not. And that was a strange finding. You would think that if her clothes were of the two, it would be the cotton that would have burned.
Local historian Ann Burns says that there were more strange findings, like the timing of the accident, if it was an accident.
The little bit of that makes me wonder, that question is, I guess she was only alone for 45 minutes and she was on fire, but the fire was barely still going when they went in there. Like, I just don't know. It's really sad and it's gruesome, but I just don't know about fire. Like, I'm glad that you're looking into that part of it, because that kind of doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Like, how did nobody smell it? But I guess house, if you're cooking, I mean, the houses in those days all just smelled smoky.
I asked Anne if we knew how long Thomas left Rebecca alone.
It's multiple people are saying it. Well, someone says an hour, one says 45 minutes, but Thomas left her room, they had dinner, there was like 45 minutes to an hour, and then Sarah sends her son Edward in to the grandmother's room to see if she wanted boiled milk or something different from dinner. So everybody in that family kind of agrees, like, it was during the time that they were having dinner.
Well, only the family says that's the timeline. It turns out that the staff and the boarder weren't there for the entirety of dinner, but we'll talk about that more later. In a little bit, we'll also learn more about fire from some forensic experts, how it catches, how it consumes, and how it kills. But for now, Gloria says, the coroner's jury had a lot to consider. Was this really an accident, or could it have been murder?
So there are a lot of things that don't add up. And, you know, it's whether or not at this stage we could ever get it to make sense. You know, we have impressions of things, but whether or not we can prove anything is another story.
Let's take a minute to talk about the idea of coroner's juries, because they're still used today, although not as often as they used to be. They started in medieval England, and they have always had a very specific purpose: to state as definitively as possible the person's cause of death. A coroner's jury doesn't decide if someone goes on trial. They are simply a panel of laypeople who review the medical evidence and make a determination. Critics of coroner's juries say that typically the jurors don't have enough medical knowledge to make such important decisions, and oftentimes they just agree with the coroner's ruling anyway. And coroners, as many of you know, are primarily elected officials, although some are appointed. In some areas, coroners don't even need to have vast medical knowledge, but they do have an edict to hire an expert to conduct autopsies. About a third of our states have medical examiners. All medical examiners are required to have medical degrees. Many states have both coroners and medical examiners. There are definitely cases where district attorneys pursue murder charges despite the verdict of the coroner's jury. The jury in the case of Rebecca Cornell was certainly not a group of experts.
There's a list of names as to who they were, and they would have been neighbors that they could get a hold of easily. And Ballston was the coroner, and he was the person that they had bought the tavern from.
So the coroner was William Ballston, and the tavern Gloria mentions is the same tavern in Boston that Thomas Cornell Sr. had essentially lost years before for not following the rules. William Ballston was a tavern keeper who had been increasingly politically active in Boston during the time the Cornells and the Hutchinsons lived there. He was also one of those people driven south to Portsmouth because of religious persecution. Boylston is considered another one of the founders of Portsmouth, like the Cornells and the Hutchinsons and the Briggs. But as a coroner, he appeared to have absolutely no medical background, just political savvy. And now, here he was leading a group of laypeople in determining Rebecca Cornell's cause of death. Thomas removed the sheet from his mother's corpse, and the group of men studied the elderly woman's body, which was still fully clothed. They couldn't recognize her, even though they all likely knew Rebecca. By now, the Cornells had given the news to Rebecca's younger brother, John Briggs. He had adored his sister, and now she was gone. In the meantime, the coroner's jury asked Thomas Cornell and Henry Strait, the farmhand, for statements. Thomas said he left his mother's room so he could go eat dinner. The next time he saw her, she was dead. Strait described finding the body and assuming it was a, quote, drunken Indian. Let's talk about that. How would anyone have ended up inside Rebecca Cornell's room in the dead of winter with a house full of family? Carrie Nolte says it wasn't that surprising to the two men on the jury or to William Boylston.
One of the things that was going on at this time was a worsening of relations between Native Americans and the colonists. So in just a few years later, King Philip's War, where atrocities on both sides are committed, will erupt. So there was another incident where a Native American was drunk and burned someone's house down. So this is kind of also, you know, they're sort of just expecting this.
Rebecca also had an outdoor, a door that led directly to the outside, inside her room. But one of the witnesses that ran into the room checked that night, and the door was fast latched from the inside, meaning it didn't require a key.
In the reports, it said that it's fast latched by one of the witnesses that runs into the room. Thomas himself says there was no lock. But a lock and a latch, they're not necessarily the same thing. Latched usually would indicate some sort of wooden bar and string paraphernalia to open it. And a lock usually would imply something metal. So Thomas could be just saying there's no lock on the door, but there is a latch, but there's no lock. But it could also just be that he was lying.
This was the beginning of many inconsistencies in this case. And soon, it would be a case. The coroner's jury did not fully examine Rebecca Cornell's body out of customary propriety. Men in the 17th century would find it inappropriate to view a woman without clothing, even if she were dead. The jurors simply listened to Thomas's story, considered the evidence, and issued a ruling on Rebecca's cause of death.
The coroner's verdict was, she was brought to an untimely death by an unhappy accident of fire. That was the original coroner's verdict.
They never considered murder. Rebecca's death was not suspicious to this group of men. She might have been smoking a pipe in bed, which would account for why the bed curtains were charred. She could have been sitting near the fire in her rocking chair and a spark ignited her flammable clothing. Maybe she tripped and fell into the fire, as Joe Ochi suggested. Regardless of the cause, it was clearly an accident, according to the jury. Case closed. This is the most magical time of the year with all the lush greenery and flowers in bloom. Bring some of that magic to your own home with fast-growing trees. They're the largest online nursery in the U.S. with over 10,000 different plants. Fast-growing trees knows everyone isn't born with a green thumb. That's why they offer a 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee and free consultations forever. If you think you need outdoor space to get growing, think again. Lemon, olive, and avocado trees can all live inside your home. Fast Growing Trees has something for everyone, and they'll deliver everything to your door in just 1 to 2 days. I ordered an Autumn Blaze maple tree from Fast Growing Trees, and it immediately started growing. Right now, I've got little leaves on, and they're starting to change color a little bit. This is the healthiest tree I've ever planted. I'm so pleased. This spring, Fast Growing Trees has the best deals online with up to half off select plants. And listeners of our podcast get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using the code TENFOLD at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com when you use the code TENFOLD at checkout. fastgrowingtrees.com and use code TENFOLD. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions apply. You've probably seen different nighttime routines. Some have so many steps that they're nearly impossible to complete when you're already so tired. Why not simplify things with a Beam routine? Beam's Dream Powder is a science-backed hot cocoa drink that's made to help you fall asleep and stay asleep. The mix comes in delicious flavors like chocolate peanut butter, cinnamon cocoa, and sea salt. Better sleep has never tasted better, and all the flavors are sugar-free. Just add a scoop to hot water or milk 30 to 45 minutes before bed. Then your body will ease into rest mode, and the Dream Powder will support you through all the stages of sleep. In a clinical study, 93% of participants reported Dream Powder helped them get better sleep. I have taken melatonin for years, and it kind of started not working for me, so I really wanted to give Beam's Dream Powder a shot. I tried the chocolate peanut butter, and it worked really well. I feel like for the first time I was able to sleep through the entire night with no problem, and I didn't wake up groggy, which is great. Find out why Forbes and the New York Times are all talking about Beam and why it's trusted by the world's top athletes and business professionals. If you want to try Beam's best-selling Dream Powder, you'll get up to 40% off for a limited time when you go to shopbeam.com/wicked and use wicked at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/wicked and use code wicked for up to 40% off. As Thomas and Sarah Cornell prepared to move on with their lives, the matrons of the village prepared Rebecca's body for burial. This was a custom going back centuries, one that actually lasted into the 20th century until funeral homes became more prevalent. Historian Gloria Schmidt says that the women had accepted the duty of readying Rebecca's corpse. It was a gruesome task, but necessary.
I know they would have tried to wash her, you know, make her clean, dress her in something that would have been clean. The habit of the women laying out the dead is a long habit, but, you know, and it would have just been her neighbors that would have come and, you know, helped out.
The matrons undressed Rebecca, which must have been traumatizing considering the state of the elderly woman's burned body. They washed her and cleaned her body as much as they could. Then they redressed her in clean, respectable clothing. Once the matrons had finished preparing Rebecca's body, there was a quiet knock at the door. Carrie Nolte says that Thomas arrived to complete another sad task.
So one of the things that happened when they laid out the body is that Thomas Jr. and a neighbor came in to measure the body for a coffin. Because again, you don't get the luxury of not being involved in everything in the town life, in this time, in this place.
It would take a few days to build the coffin, so Rebecca's body likely stayed covered up in her locked bedroom. Up until now, there had been quite a few similarities between our modern lives and the lives of the colonists. Commitment to family, the sad devolving of a once content life, then family conflict and imminent danger. But things are about to start feeling different, and they're about to get more complicated because of how religion and the supernatural had begun to merge in colonial America.
So one of the women who had laid out the body had heard that the body was purging the day after they laid it out.
I asked Carrie what that meant.
What I understand from that is that it kind of is like you're getting rid of bad demons or whatever it can be. It's based in like a folklore kind of thing. Like anything bad that was in you is now leaving. And so the body is being purified by nature.
That sounds awful. The women believed that Rebecca's body was forcing out any demons inside it through various bodily fluids, purifying itself. It was a promising sign that her soul would ascend to heaven, but it was upsetting to think that poor Rebecca Cornell had been afflicted by the devil before she died.
And so this woman went to go see it, and what she saw was Thomas and the neighbor coming out of the room. She went in and she saw no purging, or what she would assume is purging, but she did see blood about the nose, fresh blood.
This was right after?
This is 2 days after.
Well, how would fresh blood happen after?
So I tried to look it up, and I didn't get very far, but it seems like, you know, things can just kind of release. Yeah, and I think that's what, Paul would know about that.
Carrie's talking about Paul Holes, the forensic investigator who is my co-host on my other podcast, Buried Bones. I asked Paul about blood and other bodily fluids appearing the day after a body was prepared. He says that it's perfectly normal that fluids can seep out days afterwards. It wasn't a sign of anything. And Thomas and the neighbor were likely just jostling her body as they moved her around to measure her. But once the news got out, the blood caused a lot of speculation in 1673. That's because the folks in Portsmouth had certain beliefs about the relationship between a murder victim and his or her killer.
Why that is significant is because there is something called cruentation. And what that is the belief that the body will tell when the murderer is near. So fresh blood will show up. The body will begin to bleed when the murderer sometimes even just approaches the body. But if they touch the body, then that is how you would tell who the murderer is. It's sort of this folklore
Puritan
belief.
It's a Puritan thing?
This was ancient folklore beliefs just carry on despite anything.
That's pretty incredible. They believed the body would offer clues when its killer was close.
And that's part of the problem that we found in Salem and throughout colonial England, because you will find, you know, witch bottles in houses from the 17th, 18th century where it's supposed to ward off evil spirits. And they really did believe in darkness and magic and powers. They just cast it as the devil versus God. So this is a folk magic way of determining who the murderer might be. And even up into the 19th century, people were using this as a method of telling who killed someone in a small community.
Of course that doesn't happen, and it's sad to think that people would have been wrongfully executed based on folklore. But anyway, the blood on Rebecca's body caused suspicion in the village of Portsmouth. Regardless, funeral plans moved forward. The coffin was prepared, though the timing of Rebecca's burial remains uncertain, even today. Historian Ann Burns doesn't think she was buried right away because it was wintertime and the ground was very hard.
It was February. It was too cold. It was they sized her for a casket, but I don't know how true this is, but one story that I had heard was that they didn't bury bodies at that time. It was too cold. They couldn't dig the grave. So she was actually in like a body bag and maybe in a casket, but she hadn't been buried yet.
And that's an important note because the speed of decomposition of a body often depends on the temperature of where it is kept. The warmer the temperature, the faster the body degrades. Think about the difference between the coldness of the snowy outdoors versus the temperatures inside a home heated by numerous fireplaces. A body stored inside a house, even enclosed in a coffin, would decompose faster than if it were underground in February. Soon after his mother's death, Thomas returned to his work on the family farm, which must have been very difficult. But the land was his responsibility now, and I'm sure that his wife was thrilled that it was. But even so, Sarah Earle didn't show it. She remained subdued and even quiet around investigators. Until, that is, she revealed something macabre and, frankly, frightening. On the night of Rebecca's death, Sarah had run in behind her husband to find out why her stepson, Edward, was yelling for a candle. As they peered in from the doorway, Sarah stood back from everyone else for a moment before she stepped into the room. Carrie Nolte and Gloria Schmidt say that something startled Sarah.
When everyone's rushing in, they open the door and a giant black dog jumps out. Now, what that means is, interestingly, it's a reference to some folklore. In England, one of the things that can portend death, but has also taken on a connotation of devil, devilment, demons, that kind of thing, is a big black dog.
Sarah's vision at the moment the door was opened would have been terrifying for colonists.
So I think what she was saying was something evil happened to her. It wasn't us. There was something in the room with her that was evil. Because there really wasn't, nobody had the dog. There wasn't a physical dog.
The black dog seemed convincing, except Sarah seemed to be the only one who saw it. And then she began bringing up other suspicious points, like how the cotton on Rebecca's clothes didn't really burn, but the wool did. It's strange to think that she would try to draw attention to anything about her mother-in-law's death, but actually, it sounds like she may have been trying to frame Rebecca as a witch.
She says a big giant dog came out of the room and jumped over my stepson, and the wool was burned, but the cotton wasn't. And people have said she's trying to connect it to superstitions back in England, like a big dog, like that was a superstitious thing. And that maybe like there was some kind of, you know, witchcraft involved that Rebecca was involved in because, you know, her wool burned, but her cotton didn't. So, and she's the only one who mentions the dog.
Now, no one else said that they saw any dog. You would think that there's no mention of them having a pet. There's nothing. So it really seems as though she's saying that she had some sort of vision that she saw, you know, this familiar devil dog jump out, leaving, having done its mischief and gone away. Or maybe, you know, it was in cahoots with her witch of a mother-in-law.
Sarah Earle certainly knew how to spin a story that would have alarmed colonists, but was she a reliable witness?
Sarah was the source of a lot of complaints that Rebecca would. So, you know, her neighbors and everything, I'm sure they heard, oh, my daughter-in-law doesn't take care of me. I don't have enough food.
In his nearby home, John Briggs had not slept well for several nights. He mourned the death of his older sister, 9 years his senior. There had been some debate about whether they were actually blood related, but that really doesn't matter in this story, I think. They had left England together to come to America. They had been persecuted for their religion together. They both made homes in Portsmouth. Both are counted as founders of the town. And now, with Rebecca dead, John Briggs could only take comfort in his wife, Sarah, who was Thomas Cornell Sr.'s sister. On Sunday, February 12th, 3 days after the coroner's verdict, John Briggs lit the candles in his bedroom as the sky darkened early, as it does during a New England winter. John and his wife donned their bedclothes and slipped into bed. Soon, John began drifting into slumber. But before he could sleep deeply, something strange happened.
He describes feeling some weight on his blanket, I think, like some heaviness, like something there, and it woke him up. And when he woke up, he saw what he thought was a spectral figure. He saw a light, and he said, who's there? What's, you know, who's there?
And he opens his eyes, and he sees his sister kind of bathed in an ethereal light. And she says, look how I am burned with fire.
An actual waking vision. It's interpreted as a ghost. She came in spectral form and visited him. And he was half between half awake and half asleep. And That's when Rebecca Cornell said, "It is I, your sister. See how I'm burned." And she repeated that twice. But that was it.
Rebecca's spirit seemed to be stating the obvious, and it wasn't accusatory. She wasn't blaming anyone, like her son Thomas, for setting her on fire.
She never, ever said that she was murdered. But apparently, it was enough for him to say, I wonder if something happened.
She's not really accusing the son of anything. But John interprets it that way, because at that time, the idea of the spirit world is very, very common. You know, everyone would think about that as normal. And the idea that you would have someone come back from the dead, it means that there is something that needs to be cleared up. Something is not correct. And that spirit wants to right it.
Whether it was a dream or not, that fit right in with the events of the day. They were burning witches 90 miles away, and the entire population believed in the supernatural. So him having a story like that right after his sister had died, I'm sure the local population believed that.
So let's round out all the supernatural evidence that has presented itself to the frightened colonists of Rhode Island so far. Rebecca's body might have been purging itself of demons, and blood had dripped through her nose when Thomas was nearby. Her daughter-in-law saw an ominous black dog leap through the doorway, and now Rebecca's brother had been visited by her spirit. It had come to alert him that she was murdered, he believed. John Briggs jolted awake, startled and understandably upset. And then he rushed out the door and straight to the coroner. Oh boy.
John comes and says, "Look, I had this vision, and it was my sister."
On the next episode of Tenfold War Wicked on Exactly Right.
They had two people come and examine the body when Rebecca was first found, and they just assumed that it was an unfortunate, unhappy accident. Then John Briggs had his dream, and they exhumed the body and found a suspicious wound.
Everybody that has a fireplace has lots of tools around it, mm-hmm. Some of them with sharp edges.
That's a good point.
So could go either way on that one.
It's suspicious. Why does she have a wound? Why is she now burned over the wound?
There are certain things that are, you know, just more flammable than others. Like you sprinkling on a little gas, it may not be it, right? It may not be the right oxygen ratio. You might need more fuel. You might need more oxygen. Like that's the complicated chemistry. And sometimes I think it's just evil luck.
If you love true crime, check out my books, American Sherlock and All That Is Wicked. I also have an audiobook called The Ghost Club. I can't wait to tell you the real story about the world's most famous ghost hunter, who was the head of the world's most famous ghost club, and how he investigated England's most famous haunted house. This has been an Exactly Right Tenfold More Media production. Producer Jason Whaling, senior producer Alexis Amorosi, consulting producer Kyle Ryan, researcher Nicole Brown, sound designer Eric Friend, additional sound design by Nicholas Moonies, composer Curtis Heath, artwork Nick Toga, executive producers Georgia Hardstark, Karen Kilgariff, and Danielle Kramer. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Tenfold More Wicked.